From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Eric Castle, author of Animal Algorithms, Evolution, and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts. Let's now join Hank and Eric Castle in their conversation.
Termites build these amazing nests, which are really these giant mounds, and there's a lot of engineering that goes into the construction of these nests because they have a number of different elements to it. One of them is controlling the temperature within the nest, which is important because they can only exist within a certain temperature range. And then there's ventilation systems. Aspects of the nest include being able to drain water away from the core parts of the nest. They actually, in some cases, we have animals, some ants, that do farming. They actually are able to farm and use that crop that they grow, fungus type of crop, typically, that's used as a source of food. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects of this. One of the most fascinating ones that's really interesting to look at is a particular species in Australia called a compass termite. They build these really large mounds, and because Australia is located in such a hot climate, and these mounds are in the interior of the continent, typically, they have a three-dimensional design such that the narrow face of the mound faces the sun, and the wide face of the mound faces away from the sun. So it's purposely designed to minimize the heating of the mound due to the sun during the course of a day. Again, it's a really sophisticated engineering design.
So you say a social insect, like an ant or a termite, is the closest to a talented human architect. And again, just to recapitulate what you said about termites, they have nests that can reach more than 20 feet high, that include a royal chamber, nurseries, gardens, waste dumps, a well, a ventilation system that reduces heat and removes carbon dioxide. And these termites are blind. And then, as you just alluded to, they include roofs with eaves to keep water out of the nest. And I thought the most fascinating thing that you wrote about this is that the airflow design of termite nests was the inspiration for the world's first all-natural cooling building structure in Zimbabwe.
Right. Yeah, I was really surprised when I read that. There's a whole field now in science called biomimetics, where scientists and engineers take something from the world of biology, typically an animal, or from microbiology, where they're able to analyze a system that exists and take that principle of how that system is designed and apply it to a human design. And that, to me, is a perfect illustration of that.
We would be remiss if we didn't talk about spiders. You're right about spiders. And obviously, when we see a spider web, we can so glibly look at it and then look away without recognizing the absolute majesty and the fact that these spider webs are custom built. They're not one size fits all, but they're custom built. And, you know, the different kinds of silk involved in building these spider webs and the strength of this silk, I mean, it's just amazing, as you have articulated this in the book.
Yes, exactly. Humans have been trying for years to replicate the construction of silk, and you know, they've come close, but in fact, they've never been able to fully replicate a material that has all the properties that silk has. It's really amazing. Silk is constructed of a number of different proteins, And the process for manufacturing silk, again, with, when we're talking about ants, that is a complex process, and obviously it has to involve a number of genes in the genome. And these proteins are complex proteins, actually. And so the way that the spiders use it is they're actually able to produce different kinds of silk, because when they construct their webs, they actually use several different types of silk depending upon what part of the web they're actually building at the time. So in other words, they have, you know, the basic outline of the web, but then there's a number of different things they use the silk for. One of them is sort of what we would call a kind of a guy wire. And then there's also silk that the spider itself uses in addition to the web to maneuver around. So anyway, there's a number of different types of silk depending on what the need is. In other words, the strength and flexibility that's required for the function of that piece of silk within the web. And it really is amazing how, again, this is all programmed somehow in the spider, how to use the silk. It knows what silk to produce for which part of the web at which time. It really is amazing how all of that is orchestrated in a spider.
And how does a spider locate the prey?
Well, yeah, that's another really interesting aspect. The spider is able to detect the location of a prey three-dimensionally. If a prey actually gets caught in the web, the spider is able to sense the location based on the information it gets, in other words, the feedback it gets from the silk within the web. So in other words, it changes the vibration pattern of the
different... The kind of silk changes the vibration pattern?
Right, exactly.
That's because incredible.
Yeah, just like a piano string, for example, they have different vibration characteristics, and the spiders are able to sense that.
That's a mind blower in and of itself. You have an epigraph in your book. It's by Richard Dawkins, and I want you to elaborate on this. Dawkins says, "What lies at the heart of every living thing is not a fire, not warm breath, not a spark of life. It's information, it's words, it's instructions. If you want to understand life, don't think about vibrant, throbbing gels and oozes. Think about information technology." I mean, this seems to be an incredible admission on the part of Dawkins.
Yeah, I find that interesting because Dawkins does, in many cases like this one in particular, where he does recognize the existence of complexity and design. You know, he talks a lot about design, obviously, in his writings, but he doesn't really follow through on analyzing, okay, well, what's the ultimate origin of design, or in this case, information. He just kind of, you know, dismisses that as a problem for Darwinian evolution. And in the book, I go into a fair amount of discussion about the work of William Dembski and others about the problem of information in biological systems. And the work of Dembski and others is, a lot of it's based on this concept of no free lunch. In other words, there's some algorithms that mathematicians have developed where they're able to demonstrate that you basically, in the terms of information, you don't get something for nothing. You can't just create information ex nihilo out of nothing. And there's plenty of material that exists, published material in academia and others, that have demonstrated that that is the case. You really cannot just generate information out of nothing. And in particular, when you examine a Darwinian process where the claim is made that, in fact, a random process of random mutation and natural selection actually is capable of creating this kind of information that we're talking about. But really, when you examine the work that's been done by people like Dembski and others, it's a claim that really has no basis in fact. It's just it's a reach to claim that you can create, for example, some of the algorithms that we've been talking about, creating them basically from nothing. It's a big problem for Darwinian evolution.
We know of only one source of functional information, and that's intelligence. I want you to talk about something that you elaborate on in the book as well, and that is the evolutionary biologist that often is relegated to citing the great unlikelihood of the same trait arising in multiple lineages, and how that is improbable. It's improbable that exactly the same evolutionary pathway could ever be traveled twice, much less three or four or a million times.
Don't go away. We'll be right back to pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Eric Castle. Arctic terns complete the longest migration of any animal. As Eric Castle explains in his book, Animal Algorithms, in the Northern Hemisphere spring, these birds breed in the Arctic, not far from the North Pole. Several months later, they fly to the Antarctic to spend the summer in the Southern Hemisphere. Thus, they complete a round trip of 25,000 to 30,000 miles. How and why do they do that? And can the unguided, purposeless process posited by neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory actually account for this complex programmed animal behavior? Read all about it in Animal Algorithms, Evolution and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts by Eric Castle. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and his guest Eric Castle in their conversation.
It's improbable that exactly the same evolutionary pathway could ever be traveled twice, much less three or four or a million times.
Right. And that, again, this is another one of the big challenges for Darwinian evolution. And that's this concept that they call convergent evolution, where a characteristic will show up in organisms that they know to be completely unrelated, so it couldn't be common descent. So that's been a problem that's been recognized, at least for a long time, in physical terms. When you look at the fossil record, for example, going back over millions of years, where they see characteristics, physical characteristics, indicating where organisms have a similar kind of characteristic that they know they're unrelated. So that's been a challenge. And what I talk about is how you have the same kind of a challenge that's obvious now in regard to animal behaviors, where you have behaviors that show up in completely unrelated animal taxa. But again, the problem is that Darwinians just use this term, oh, it's convergent evolution. Well, it's a term really without any meaning. The part of that they use to actually try to explain it is this concept that they call selection pressure, meaning that there's pressure due to natural selection for these characteristics to occur in different animal groups in this case. Well, again, that's another sort of a fallacious argument where, first of all, a lot of Darwinians don't even agree that there's this nebulous concept called selection pressure. In other words, it's a fallacious argument logically, because they're saying, okay, there's something in the environment that's creating this theoretical pressure for an organism to evolve in a certain way. Well, the more you think about it and examine the whole concept, it just kind of falls apart. The only aspect of this that I give any credence to is the work that some people have done in the so-called evo-devo world, where there is evidence in some cases, for example, in the case of birds, let's say, if you have an animal that's going to be flying, there are certain characteristics of wings that are necessary, and other aspects of the animal, in this case a bird, that are common. In other words, you have certain wing designs that will be sufficient for flight. Well, you can, at least conceptually, you can think, okay, well, that's going to constrain the evolution of an animal that's going to fly, that their wings are going to have pretty similar characteristics. So that's somewhat plausible, and you can say the same thing about fish in terms of the fin designs, etc. But in the case of, like, the animal behaviors that I talk about, many of these complex behaviors, there's really no constraint. There's nothing constraining the way that such behaviors could or would develop. They're entirely independent. There's nothing forcing a behavior to occur in one group of animals in a similar way to a completely unrelated group of animals. That just isn't the case in terms of these behaviors. So this whole idea of convergent evolution and selection pressure, I don't believe even apply to the things that I've talked about.
I want to go through a bit of a lightning round with you to end this podcast, and it has to do with common objections to intelligent design. Let me just enumerate some of them as you do in the book and then get your quick response. So one of the common objections to intelligent design is it's religion. It's not science.
Yeah, that's a fallacy. The work that all of the people that have been working on intelligent design, for example, the work of Michael Behe, Steve Meyer, others, if you examine their work, it's all science. There's not a religious aspect to the technical work that goes into their research and their arguments. It is science.
It's following truth wherever it leads. The National Academy of Sciences notes that intelligent design is not a scientific concept because it cannot be empirically tested.
Yeah, and that's not true. One way of thinking about it is in a similar way that evolutionary theory, they examine the fossil record. Well, the fossil record is an empirical way of examining the history of animals throughout time. That's empirical. In the same way, those of us working in ID are doing the same thing. And again, all of the information and research described in my book is based on empirical evidence.
Here's another one. Intelligent design appeals to teleology. It appeals to purpose. And that's not allowed in science. It's verboten, as your German friend Gunther Beckley would put it. It's forbidden because the goals or purposes that you're alluding to have no place in biology. They only have a place in the study of human behavior.
Yeah, again, that's back to the same problem of not allowing the discussion even about some higher level goals or purpose when talking about biological systems. But it's just, again, it's a fallacy that, in that case, that one actually does lead to a dead end in science. And again, a different example here would be these insect social colonies, where there really is some higher level set of goals and purposes that are designed into the function of these social colonies. Well, if you're not even allowed to talk about that, you're stopping science at that point. So, it's a really fallacious argument.
Yeah, that's well said. Let me just mention one more. We haven't covered all of the objections that you cover in the book, but one of the objections that I want to end with is the objection of the problem of who designed the designer. So there's a thought in the minds of people that if you have a designed universe, then you have to have a designer of that designed universe. And then the question is, who designed that designer? And then you have an infinite regress.
Yeah, and again, that's a common objection that some people use. Richard Dawkins in particular used it in his book, The God Delusion. It's really, that's a philosophical and theological issue that I didn't want to go into too deeply in the book, because there's plenty of other philosophers that have addressed this, like William Lane Craig. I highly recommend his writings. But there's plenty of other ones that have addressed that particular issue. Again, it's really a fallacious argument.
It is. And so many of the arguments against intelligent design are not well thought out. And I really appreciate the fact that you give the objection and then you give a cogent answer to that objection. I think is helpful to everybody that reads your book. But what's most fascinating about this book to me is the actual insects that you talk about. It opens this Lilliputian world of enormous complexity and design that cannot be explained away by blind macroevolutionary processes. Animal algorithms, evolution, and the mysterious origin of ingenious instincts by Eric Castle. This book, available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, it's a must read. It's something that you want to have in your library. And you can take, even with your kids, you can take one example and you can start intoxicating them with the mystery and the majesty of something that seemingly is so simple as an ant. And when you start to unravel that Lilliputian world in the mind of a child, their minds will be directed in a proper trajectory. I think this book is just ingenious in so many different ways. It's interesting. It's a relatively quick read for the kind of complex information that's going to be opened up as a whole world for you to explore for the rest of your life. And then when you're outdoors or even indoors and you see some of these creations, you look at them through different eyes. So I really deeply appreciate the work that you've done in this regard.
Well, thanks again, Hank. I really appreciate your comments, and I'm humbled that you're so supportive for the book. I'm really thankful for your support.
Well, it is with the entirety of my heart that I support this book, Animal Algorithms. You can find a copy on the web at equip.org. And I think if you've followed Eric in this podcast, I think you'll want to read the book. And you certainly will see him as one of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you next time with another edition of Hank Unplugged. So long for now.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Eric Castle. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Animal Algorithms, Evolution and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts by Eric Castle. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. Once again, that's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. Of course, you can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.